invitation to tell you a little bit about some work that we did with Andrea Guerrieri and John Panadonis called Where is String Theory? And also we wrote a paper with a similar title with Arish Murali that I'll try to give you a flavor of what these works were. Okay, so please let me know when I have like 10, 15 minutes left so I can better gauge. I don't have white chalk, I have green chalk. I hope it's okay that you can see. So let me start drawing a plot that I think is very nice, and then I'll explain what this plot is. So this plot has two axes. One is rough, is beta, one is alpha, and then there is a region like this, something like this. And there is some region here. And then the minimum value that this parameter alpha takes, this minimum value is 0.139. So let me tell you what this plot is. So these are a plot of numbers. You see, we are plotting beta is a number, alpha is a number, so they have no dimensions. And there is some region inside here. And then there is a minimum value that one of these numbers can take. Okay. So what we will be studying, what I will be presenting today, are the space of UV completions of maximally supersymmetric supergravity in d bigger or equal than 5 dimensions. Okay, so let me address that. Of course, we would like to study completion of our gravity in 4 dimensions, not maximally supersymmetric gravity in 10 dimensions. Well, we start with what we can, and I will explain in what sense this restriction to having supersymmetry or the restriction to being in d bigger of 5 dimensions, are they really conceptual obstacles or are they technical tools that we are using for now? And that will become clear soon. And the spoiler is that I believe SUSE is not a big deal. D bigger or equal than 5, there are some conceptual subtleties that maybe people can give me some hints on how to overcome. Okay? So SUGRA not a big deal. D bigger or equal than 5, for now it is a big deal. And so what do we know about gravity, about supergravity, generically? So we know that at low energies, we have gravity. And then as we increase energy, it's UV completed. So let's write that in an equation. Let's suppose I study scattering of gravitons, and I have two gravitons scattering with two gravitons. And that will describe some scattering amplitude, A, that will depend on the energy, on the various Lorentz invariants. S, for example, would be related to the center of mass energy of the incoming particles. T would be 413, U 414. So this parameterizes the scattering of the process. And what is this? So this is, so there is first some tensor. So this is a tensor. Let me comment on a second on what this is. And then there is 1 over S times T times U. This is the low energy universal prediction. So this is supergravity here. This is just gravity. And this is the leading behavior when S, T, and U are small. And then there is plus the UV completion. Now, I said I'm scattering gravitons, but I'm writing a function, and gravitons have polarizations and so on. So that's all hidden inside this tensor. So this tensor is where all the polarizations of the gravitons, all the indices, and so on are hidden. And normally, when we have a theory of supergravity, you could say, well, but you can scatter many things. You can scatter gravitons. You can scatter the supersymmetric partners of the graviton. And maximal supersymmetry, what it buys you is that all these processes are related. So all the scattering of two gravitons going to two gravitons or two dilatons going into two dilatons, it's all the same thing. It's all the same function up to an overall tensor. And so when I extract a particular scattering process, the scattering process is given by this parenthesis times some very simple factor that comes from this tensor. Okay? The simple factor could be S to the 4. For example, for some component. or it could be ST plus SU plus UT for another component. So different scattering amplitudes just extract different components of this tensor. Otherwise, we have this function here. And let me call this function, say, I already used A. Okay, I will use A without boldface. And what is this UV completion? So this UV completion organizes itself by powers of energy. And if it starts with a constant, and that constant, you see, we have 1 over STU, each of them has energy square. So that constant would be proportional to L Planck to the 6 times a constant. And let's call this constant alpha. Then, as we start increasing the energy further, there will be some loop effects that would come with some power of L Planck to the d minus 2 times some function of S, T, and U that describe this first loop effect. And this process is universal. It's universal because it's effectively made of 2 3-level effects, and the 3-level effects are universal in gravity. So that first correction that shows the first loop, that one doesn't have any new constant. The constant is just 1 because it's just 3-level square. If you continue going further, you would find then there is some term LP to the 10 times U square plus S square plus T square. So you see that everything is symmetric under permutations of S, T, and U. That's just crossing symmetry. It's just a statement that I can look at my process from many directions. Plus dot, dot, dot. And this new term comes with a new constant, and that constant is beta. So you see, we measure everything in units of L Planck. Then this alpha and beta are numbers. And the question we ask is, what are these numbers? Different UV completions give me different numbers. And so the question, that's the question we are going to study, is what values could these numbers take, alpha and beta? And here I drew a plot. And this plot is what alpha and beta are in one UV completion, which is string theory. So this, what this plot represents is the allowed range of alpha and beta in type 2B string theory. So string theory is one UV completion of supergravity. String theory depends on a coupling, which is the probability of a string splitting into two. And so because it depends on this tunable coupling, string theory gives you a range, and it doesn't give you just a number. And so that's why there's a full region instead of just a point. However, this region has some interesting structure. It has some beautiful cusps, and it has, in particular, for example, some minimum value that alpha needs to be. So in string theory, there are many values alpha could take, but alpha could not take the value 0.05. That's not inside string theory. Okay? So if someone measures and does an experiment and finds alpha equals 0.05, that's not string theory. Okay, very good. And so the question we would like to ask is, what is being agnostic about the UV completion? I don't care if it's string theory or not, but I just ask, what's the minimum value of alpha? That's a very well posed question. So that's the question I'm going to tell about. Any question here? Yeah.
Two fundamental parameters in a string theory that control alpha and beta. That's why it's a two-dimensional region? Or are there more than
two? Yeah, there is a two-dimensional integral because the coupling is really a complex coupling, and it covers a region. In type 2A, it would be a line.
Okay.
So there are others. There is another string theory, which is called type 2A, and it would describe a line, and that line would do some shape like this. It would go a little bit out of the type 2B curve and do something like this, and the minimum value in type 2A would be slightly above 0.42, something like that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so it's a two-dimensional coupling. Sorry? Yeah. Of course, yeah, yeah.
How are alpha and beta related to alpha prime and GS? And would to alpha prime and GS? And also, would the higher order operators, I don't know if you computed them, affect that region?
Yeah, so what are these alpha and beta from a Lagrangian point of view? They are related to the coefficients of the higher derivative terms that show up in the effective action. And therefore, at low energy, I can drop them and I get supergravity. And then, as I increase energy, I start finding the first curvature correction, and then the second curvature correction, and so on. Another thing you said was alpha prime. Alpha prime is L string.
Yes.
L string is not a new parameter. In fact, L string over L Planck is a dimensionless quantity, and that's just a function of the coupling. Right? So,
okay, so
changing, I only have one dimension full quantity. I don't have two. So I have L, if I fix L Planck to one, then L string is not a new parameter. L string is just some simple function of the coupling times L Planck.
Okay, so these alpha and beta do not depend on alpha prime.
Alpha and beta in string theory depend on the ratio of alpha prime over L Planck in dimensionless units. They are functions of L string over L Planck, which is the coupling. And they cover this full region. So this region here, for example, is the region where alpha and beta are huge. So that means that if you were to UV complete gravity, you would find string theory very quickly. So that's the regime of perturbative string theory. So Virasoro-Shapiro and Veneziano and so on sit here in the easy regime, the perturbative regime. And this would be the very quantum regime of string theory, a harder regime to study.
Thanks.
Welcome. Any other questions? Yeah, there is one question there.
I'd like to know why the right-hand side doesn't have a tensor dependence.
Why this right-hand side here doesn't have a tensor dependence?
The right to that part, the correction.
Yeah, so the fact that you can study one function, which you call the amplitude, instead of many functions for many processes, is supersymmetry. It's supersymmetry that tells you that all these processes are basically the same up to trivial kinematical factors, and therefore they can be put in a tensor in front. So now, if you have a theory without supersymmetry, you cannot describe 2-to-2 processes just with one single function. You need more functions. But the conceptual, it's the same thing as I'm going to say, but you would have more functions, they would be coupled to each other, and it's the difference between working with one function or 4 or 5 functions if you don't have supersymmetry.
But I mean where the alpha and beta coefficients, they don't have a tensor dependence?
No, here they don't have tensor dependence. No, they are just numbers. All the tensor dependence sits in front. Any other question? That's because we have maximal supersymmetry, so all processes are related to the same. Otherwise, for example, the scattering of, I don't know, positive-positive to positive-positive helicity and positive-negative to positive-negative, there would be two functions. And I would have a function A1 and a function A2, and that's not a big deal. But what is a big deal, as you will see, is this D bigger or equal than 5, and I can already anticipate, obviously, you are guessing the reason, which is infrared divergences and the fact that the gravity is a long-range force, and so it's harder to define properly amplitudes if we are in lower dimensions. Okay, so let's try to solve this problem. So the idea of finding, of doing some optimization problem is finding the allowed space, to find this allowed space of alphas. What I want to say to do is think, what is the general possible UV completion? What's the most general UV completion, first of all? I forget about string theory and I write the most general ansatz here. Within that ansatz, I then minimize alpha. I do an optimization problem. Subject to physics. So now we have to impose what physical constraints we are going to impose. So there are two steps. One step is an ansatz, is writing something that describes all possible UV completions. Second step is imposing physics. And then we can do minimization of alpha, which is contained in the ansatz, subject to physics. Okay, so that's the strategy for solving this problem. Okay. So the proposal is the following. So let's write here a UV completion. Now let's think, so what is this, what do we know about this function? We know that this function, as a function of s, it's a function that will have a cut starting at s equal to 0. This cut, for example, is already in this one loop function that I described. And why do we just have a cut? Because we have a continuum of states of any possible energy, right? So we have any continuum of states. So when you cut, these states can have any positive energy, and therefore there is a cut starting at s equal to 0. So we are not dealing with a meromorphic function. We are dealing with functions that have this cut. So what we can do is the following. We can go to a point here, call it, say, s equal minus 1, where the amplitude is regular, and try to do a Taylor expansion around this point. By the way, minus 1, of course, means minus 1 over L Planck square, right? We are in units of L Planck. So we go to s equal to minus 1, and we could do a Taylor expansion here. This would be good, except that it would not be allow us to go here, because we would hit this cut as we do a Taylor expansion. So going here and doing a Taylor expansion, we'll have a finite radius of convergence that will stop here. So we need to do something slightly smarter. And the something slightly smarter is the following. We can map this cut plane to a unit disk with a conformal transformation, such that this point is mapped here, infinity is mapped here, and the top part of the cut is mapped to the top part of this, and similarly, the bottom part of the cut is mapped to the bottom part of the disk, such that circles here, a simple expansion with circles here, correspond here to circles that then, as you increase, start getting deformed, and foliate the full cut plane like this. And this is a very simple conformal map that does this. Okay? So there exists such a map. Okay? So I just find the map that foliates space like this, and that sends the cut S plane to the unit disk. But now in the unit disk, I have a meromorphic function that converges everywhere. Okay, so let's do that. So we write plus a sum of this map, rho s, to the power n. We sum from n, but we also have t variables, and we also have u variables, and we sum over n, m, and k all the way to infinity with some coefficients, c, n, m, okay. And these coefficients are symmetric. It's a symmetric under permutations of n, m, k, and that imposes crossing symmetry. And so here is an ansatz that should describe everything, provided we put infinitely many coefficients, which were, in this physics, crossing symmetry, Lorentz symmetry, crossing is trivialized. It's done. What is not done, and that's what we now need to do, is unitarity. Okay? So that's what we need to impose. Okay? Any question about this ansatz? Again, the assumption here is that, it's just true. Okay, so now we need to impose unitarity. What's unitarity? Unitarity is the statement that probabilities are smaller than one. So what we want to do is take this amplitude here and ask that the probability of scattering two gravitons into two gravitons is smaller or equal than one. And that is an extra constraint that we have to impose. And that condition looks like as follows. So first, what you should do is go to this incoming state. And instead of thinking of ST and U, prepare some state that has some center of mass energy and some angular momentum L. In this angular momentum basis, angular momentum is conserved. So if I start with a state with two particles and angular momentum 4, I will get a state with angular momentum 4. And I ask if the probability of getting that state is smaller or equal than 1. So let's write that. So So the probability of being in spin L at some energy s is equal to the square of the amplitude of being with some spin L and some energy s square, as usual in quantum mechanics, where this SL, what is this SL? This SL is equal to the following. If the theory was free, it is just 1, plus there is some simple normalization, a factor of s to the power of d over 2 plus 2, some integral over an angle, z is cosine of the scattering amplitude, that you integrate to project into spins. You project with some one, with some simple factor of the angle and some Legendre polynomials of spin L of z. Well, in the dimensions, they are not exactly Legendre. They are Gegenbauers, but they reduce to Legendres in four dimensions. Times, importantly, the amplitude. Evaluated at what? At s. And then when I parameterize t and u in terms of the angle, I get something simple like this. So you see that s plus t plus u is automatically 0. And so this SL is just a projection of my amplitude integrated over the angle to project into definite spin L. Now, you see, this amplitude grows. So I start with something well-behaved, and eventually this grows with s to the d over 2. And what does it mean? It means that this probability that we need to impose is smaller or equal than 1 is in danger, because it starts growing. Right? So what is the statement? The statement is we need to unitarize it. So the point is that this wants to grow, and this factor here needs to cancel this growth to make sure things behave nicely. And that's what tells you that you cannot not have new physics. Alpha could not be 0.05. That would not be strong enough to unitarize the theory. So you need new physics coming in earlier. Okay? So that will be, that's the main idea. You also see that we are integrating over an angle with some d over 2 minus 2. And if you remember that A was 1 over STU, if you plug, you get some singularity at 1 minus Z. And you ask, is this problematic or not? And it's all okay as long as you are in D bigger or equal than 5. But if you are in D equal to 4, you would have to be careful about collinear divergences, which we know exist in four-dimensional physics of massless particles. Okay? Okay. Very good. So now it's clear what you do. The physics that you impose, the minimization over this physics. The physics is what? The physics is that we impose this constraint over there. Let me call it star. And where do we impose it? We impose it for a bunch of spins, spin 0, spin 2, spin 4. These are identical particles, so only even spin shows up to some maximum spin. We impose it for energies S inside some grid. For many, many energies, we impose that this is always true. And so we have the number of elements in this grid. We have how many spins we impose. In practice, when we do numerics, we replace infinity by some big number n that is another parameter. And then the question is, as I take these parameters to infinity, what do I explore and what value of alpha do I manage to get? Okay? So what is the allowed value of alpha that I can get? Now it's a problem of just plugging this ansatz. So you see, you plug this expression inside this integral. That's just a linear map. This is just some linear operation that gives me a linear combination of the C's. And that linear combination of those constant C's needs to be smaller or equal than 1.
A bit confused about whether A is real or complex.
Yeah, A is these constants here are real.
Why?
Sorry. Yeah, there is an I missing here.
Thank you.
Very good. Well spot. It's inside N, right? So I didn't tell you what this. This is a bunch of pi's and so on. But indeed, as Neil is pointing out, we start with free theory, right? And then the first correction unitarizes free theory. Very good. I have 5 minutes. Perfect. And so now, if I had 1 hour, I will show you how we will take this number of parameters of the grid to infinity, a number of parameters L to infinity, a number of parameters N to infinity, and how exactly do we do this study. But since this is a shorter talk, I will just tell you what the final result is. Okay? But is the logic well clear now? So we impose this constraint. So these constraints, you see this unitarity condition, all these unitarity conditions, you can think that each unitarity is like some kind of constraint like this, like this, like this. You have a bunch of conditions that you are inside this region. And in this higher dimensional space of C's, one of this direction will be alpha. And then you will be doing some simple optimization problem. You go up, you hit the wall, you come, you hit, and eventually you converge to the optimal value of the minimum value of alpha you could get. Notice I drew it, these conditions, and this space here, I drew it as a convex space. That's not an accident. This is a convex problem. Unitarity is a convex problem, so it's a very nice problem for optimization. When you have a convex, if you are in a convex room and want to find what's the biggest point there, you just walk in that direction. Right? Then if you hit walls, you keep walking until you go there. And so we managed to find the minimum value, and the minimum value we find is the allowed value we find is here, which is a 0.25. Slightly below string theory. And so the claim, what we would say, is that this region up here in alpha is allowed. Okay? So let's interpret this result. So first, what does it mean? It means that string theory is possible. Okay, good. So we did not kill string theory. Maybe some of you would like us to kill string theory, but that didn't happen. Now, it also looks like there is a little bit of space between what is allowed and string theory. Now, this, we have strong evidence to believe that just because we only imposed one constraint, one amplitude. There's so much more we could impose. More amplitudes need to be positive, more amplitudes need to be unitary, and so on. So it's the conjecture is that if I impose more constraints, perhaps it could go exactly to string theory and nothing more. Now, does it mean that string theory is the only possible UV completion? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that the minimum value of all that string theory seems to cover more or less everything, but there could be another theory of quantum gravity that also has this alpha 0.139. That's fine. It shows that, however, that there is no theory of quantum gravity that produces an alpha which is 0.05. This doesn't exist. Now, what would we like to do next is first we want to understand finally, what's the message? Is string theory unique or not? Are there other ways of completing? And here we got just a number. We got 0.125, right? So it's like, what's the meaning of life? It's 42, right? So it's similar. And here we got a number. So there are obvious things we should do. One thing is not study just alpha, study alpha and beta. Then we have really a surface, a plane, a domain. That's much less trivial than just one number. We could do it. It's just numerically very expensive. So this used basically 60% of PI's cluster. So if you, people that use the cluster probably see that Andrea is always taking most of the queue. And it would be very expensive, but we could try. We should try. What we typically try to do is try to push more and more the numerical method before putting it in a cluster. So we are warming up to try to study this two-dimensional space. What we already did is ask, could this be a coincidence because this plot here was in 10 dimensions? Could it be a coincidence? Should we try other dimensions? We tried 9 and 8 dimensions. And we got similar, very close numerical coincidences for very different numbers. So so we tried a few other dimensions, bigger or equal than 5, where we also kind of know what region string theory covers. And we found, again, a very striking coincidence. So the conjecture would be that perhaps the only possible theory would be string theory, but there is so much more work to do, and I would be happy either way. If we find that there is room, and that the space has much more space. That's also super exciting, and I don't have any particular bias. So, and yet another thing that we should do is relax supersymmetry. Relaxing supersymmetry, as you hopefully see, is not as complicated as going to four dimensions. It's just a question that we'll have more functions, and now we will not be imposing one unitarity condition, but it will be a matrix condition with many amplitudes and so on. It's again numerically much more complicated. So as a proof of principle, we start with the simplest case. The simplest case is the case where one amplitude is related to all amplitudes, and that's what we studied here. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Pedro, for the nice talk. I see three questions. John was first, then Robert, and then Fernando, if we have time.
So if you're actually doing this, I would think there would be logarithms in some of those loop functions, and so that these parameters, like alpha, would be running parameters. You just have it as a pure number. What about logarithms and non-analytic behavior and running parameters?
Yeah, they are there. So as I said, if you remember, the first term was alpha. Then there was beta, but in between there was this F1. This F1 does contain these non-analytic terms at one loop.
Right.
Then after beta, there are more non-analytic terms.
Right.
And so on. So you always have this. Now it turns out that here, this alpha comes in at an energy before the non-analytic terms. That is not, this was, if you remember, alpha was coming, there was this alpha was at L Planck to the 6. Beta was at L Planck to the 10, and these non-analytic terms, these one-loop terms, were coming at L Planck to the d minus 2. So it, depending on what is d, these non-analytic terms typically are in between these two for the cases we studied. But alpha was before, always before these one-loop terms kick in.
So would they get mixed up if you went down to d equals to 4, do they get mixed up in d equals to 4?
At d equals... I'm not sure if this is, maybe it's d plus 2, yeah. Yeah, probably d plus 2. So at d equals 4, they would be at the same order of alpha.
Okay.
And so you would need to disentangle them. But they are universal, right? So they come with a universal coefficient. So we could immediately in the ansatz put them with the right coefficient 1, and we know what the coefficient of these non-analytic terms are. In fact, we did precisely this with Andrea and Juan when we studied pions. Pions is an example where you also have a low energy expansion, and there the non-analytic terms and the first correction to the pion Lagrangian comes in at the same order, and you need to do precisely this.
Okay, great, thank you.
Right. Then next was Robert.
Yes. Can you explain how the number 0.139 for string theory came, for type 2B string theory came from?
Sorry, could you say again?
So how did you get this number 0.139 for type 2B?
Okay, so it just turns out that, so I'll tell you what alpha is in string theory. So alpha in string theory, it's a function of tau, and it's a known Eisenstein series that people like Michael Green and others found by studying S-duality of the theory and this function is given by something like a sum over n. I'm not going to be able to do it. It's some Eisenstein series 3/2 that is a known function that appears a lot in number theory where you sum over. And this function has some nice properties under modular transformations of tau. And imposing that a theory as S-duality, we are able to fix alpha and beta completely. Now, what you might, of course, we have no idea what is a string theory amplitude at this value. This is very strongly coupled. But we know the first two low energy coefficients. So alpha and beta, we know, of course, we don't know all the coefficients in string theory. We just know the lower ones because the lower ones are effectively in string theory very constrained by S-duality.
And then, since we're running out of time, please, very short question and short answer, and then there's more time for questions.
No, I think I'll leave it for later, yes.
All right, okay. Then we close the session. Thanks a lot again to all the speakers of today. And we...